Hey, what's going on? This is David Boy James.
Hey, this is Scott Owen.
Hi, this is Deborah Lynn.
We're Rosewood Avenue.
Hey, everybody, this is Kadu, and you are listening to Canadian Country Music Podcast with your man, Tim Albertson. Most don't
know. What's up, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Canadian Country Music Podcast. This is episode 15. I am your host, Tim Albertson, a Canadian country music artist and lover who has been infatuated with every aspect of the Canadian country music world. The ins, the outs, the moments behind the stage, the songs, the business, and of course, share our stories with our fans. On today's episode, we chat with CBC programmer Julian Tuck. So artists, please listen up. But before we begin, we need to talk about our incredible sponsor, Hooligan Fuel Hot Sauce. Not only does this incredible company house a variety of hot sauce brands like Birthday Biatch, Limey Bastard, Crandemic, Creeping Heat, and more, myself and Hooligan Fuel have joined together to create my new hot sauce, which will be announced in the next few days. Honey, whiskey, and barbecue. Keep an eye open on their website, Hooligan Fuel. That's HOOLIGANFUEL.com for more details. Now, on today's podcast, we have CBC music programmer, Mr. Julian Tuck. Julian first got the radio bug after graduating Humber College. He then moved in from radio to join two record labels before coming back to the airwaves. For the last 13 years, Julian has found himself a home with CBC Music, including the programming for SiriusXM CBC Country Channel 171. Julian is an encyclopedia of music knowledge from all genres, and as you will soon find out when listening, extremely passionate about the arts. So cozy on up to the fire, get that hot cocoa ready, because our chat with Mr. CBC Music himself, Julian Tuck, begins in 3, 2, 1.
Well, there's a spot way back in the boondocks.
All right, welcome everyone to another episode of the Canadian Country Music Podcast, sponsored by Hooligan Fuel Hot Sauce, where you can get the best tasting hot sauce for every occasion at hooliganfuel.com. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you so much for tuning into the live premiere. Please make sure to click and subscribe to our channel and hit that bell button to know that you are watching. Also, give us the good old thumbs up because you love us. If you are watching the premiere, please make sure to click the live chat button and chat with us now. Now, if you're listening on any major podcast streaming platforms such as Spotify or Anchor or Apple Music, thank you so much for listening today. I am your host, Tim Albertson, Canadian country artist and lover, and today, student. Today, I hope you guys have your pens and paper ready because today is the guest of the programming director for CBC music channels, including SiriusXM CBC Country on channel 171, or number one on my pre-saves in my truck. Julian has had his influence in the industry since being first hired from his class in 1983 from Humber College. Ironically enough, the exact same day Reagan was shot. He has been a radio host as well as a promoter for AMN as well as True North Records. And for the last 13 years, he has been the programmer at CBC. Today, we get to pick the brain of one of the most influential people in the Canadian country music industry. Canadian country podcast listeners, give it up today for my incredible host coming to us from Toronto, Ontario, Julian Tuck. Sir, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
You're welcome, Tim. Good to be here.
It is my absolute pleasure. When I first started this podcast, Julian, my first mind was I really wanted to get you on this show because I knew that you had a brain that I really desperately wanted to pick.
It's been pushing my hair out for a lot of years.
Well, first off, let's dig in a little deeper into your background. Where did you first get hit with the music bug?
I was born in England. So right away, you got to say Beatles.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, I mean, I was born in 1962 in the south of England. The first record I remember liking was Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how old I was. I think it was The Growl. Mm-hmm. I just remember liking that on the radio, being, you know, probably 4 years old or something. But the Beatles were a huge influence, you know, at a level that I don't even understand. But let's put it this way. I got lost in Selfridges, the big department store on Oxford Street. My dad worked there.
Okay.
And I don't know how old I was. I was about four, I guess. I got lost in the store. And when a woman found me and eventually reconnected me with my mom, she leaned in quietly and said, "Is his name really Ringo?" I don't recall it at all. But again, it's the influence that band had.
True that. And
continues to have, you know? So really, that's where I got the music bug. The radio bug is a different thing.
Okay.
The radio bug hit me in my teens. And I, you know, I'd always liked radio. It was always where it was where you went for new music.
Yeah.
It was where everything happened, right? It was where you got everything you wanted to hear was on the radio, especially in the early 70s. So my parents had a store in Kitchener, Ontario. They decided to do some advertising on Chime, the local AM station.
Okay, yeah.
And so I was, I don't know, 13 or 14. I went along with my mom, who ended up being the voice for the commercial. And I saw they gave us a little tour, and I saw the guy in the booth, and, you know, he looked like an air traffic controller. Had this big board, all these windows, and something went off in my head, and I kind of went, I want to do that. That looks like it could be fun. And so it started from there. And then in grade 12, I booked Max Webster into my high school.
Oh, wow.
Which sounds like a big deal. But, in 1979, bands, you know, it was a completely different touring circuit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of bands were doing 3 and 4 nights at one club.
Yeah.
You'd do a week at a club. You know, everywhere had an airliner. I don't know why.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, Max Webster and other bands, Gatto, any band of the day, were still fulfilling their obligation and playing high schools.
Oh, okay.
And so I saw Max Webster play in Uxbridge, Ontario. And one of my best friends was the social convener for the high school. And I said, you know, we could get these guys in Sutton. And 2 months later, they played Sutton, Ontario.
Oh, wow. That feels like that should be on their signs for their actual towns. Eh? Like Max Webb played here once.
Like, I don't know if they've had another show at the high school in however many years it's been. I don't even want to start thinking. It's like 40-something.
Even for me, like, I grew up in a small town of Dorion and Herkett, so that's an hour outside of Thunder Bay, so it's like 150 to 300 population. And, like, we had Amanda Stock come through, we had Michelle Wright, and they all stopped and they played at our public schools. Now, the public school had maybe a 300 capacity, but I could tell you that those tickets sold out the second that they came out. So
it's the only thing going on in town.
Exactly.
I mean, and we sold out my high school gig, you know, and the band walked away with, if memory recalls, like $5,600 for the night, which is pretty good. We made some money for the school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really my first foray into the quote unquote music industry.
I bet to have that good, like, progress at the very beginning must have been really nice for you, because I've been a promoter and my very first job as a promoter did not nearly go as well.
Well, it was weird because at the end of the day, I didn't control anything. Right. I was 17 years old. The principal or vice principal had to sign the contract.
Yeah.
But I got on the phone. I probably called Anthem Records first.
Oh, okay.
And they put me onto their booking agent. And my mom did the catering that night. I had to hire cops. I had to hire an electrician, security, like all kinds. Yeah. There were all kinds of things. And I can remember when it came, you know, to decision time, I can remember sitting in the vice principal's office and he had the contract in front of him. And he said, well, I see you doing all the work and then walking away with 75% of the gate. And I said, well, I've been working on this for 3 weeks and I've learned more in 3 weeks than I've learned in 4 years in this school. And the reality is that what I've learned is what I'm going to do for a living in some way, shape or form. I mean, I learned so much.
Yeah.
From just doing that, it was self-discipline. It was being organized.
Mm-hmm.
It was all of that. It was just picking up the phone and making a couple of phone calls and learning as you went along, just like everybody else when you start out. You know?
Exactly. So I recall hearing in an online interview you had that you left because of music and you came back because of music. First off, what made you leave?
Yeah, as I always say, I got into radio because I like music. I got out of radio because I like music. I think part of that is just when you're young, you think you know how the world works. And you think, hey, I'm going into radio. And you have that WKRP kind of thing where it's mm-hmm. like, oh, no DJ picks his own music anymore. And it hasn't been that way for years and years and years.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, campus, you know, you can get into various levels where, sure, you pick all your music.
Yeah, or independent online stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but the reality is, and it was funny, when I went to Humber College, they had a format for their campus station, which was only in-house. You could only hear it like in the cafeteria, but they made us do a format because, as the coordinator said, what's the point in teaching you something if you're going to leave here, go to a station, and not be prepared to play the same 300 or 400 songs over and over and over again?
Very true.
So yeah, I mean, I got into radio because of my love of music, and I got out of it because of my love of music. I ended up working at a label.
What part, like, when did you decide that label was the route for you at that time?
I think I was getting disillusioned with radio at the time. I mean, I was all of 22 or 23 years old. And, you know, even radio, it was always about, you know, I wasn't the kid in the neighborhood, but certainly amongst my friends, I was the guy who was always like, you got to hear this. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to hear this new Jackson Brown record, or you got to hear whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so radio gave you that outlet. A record company gave you a completely different outlet. And all of a sudden, every Monday, you're walking into radio stations with a bag full of hits. True. So it's just a bigger version of you got to hear this.
Okay. So then again, what brought you from the label back to radio?
The slow death of labels. You know, I mean, I watched the record industry, you know, it had to change. You know, CDs became prevalent. You just watched sales go down and down and down and down. Once file sharing was, you know, a thing, mm-hmm. then you started to see a steady decline in sales. Obviously the record industry continues. It's, you know, it's morphed and changed its ways to adjust to, you know, the realities of today. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's what made me go to a label, was just more opportunity. And again, as a music, you know, when you're a music person, you go to, you know, I know lots of people who went to radio because they were music people. The record industry is littered with people who started in radio.
Oh, wow.
You know, because at the end of the day, we're all music lovers. And yeah. It's just not, it's an opportunity to work in an artistic field every day.
I like that. I like that. I'm going to write that down.
There you go.
Perfect. So you're with CBC Music when Sirius and XM Canada kind of do their merger.
Yep.
Now, obviously, you're a few rows below where the actual decision gets made, but
I'm a couple of floors lower than that.
Yeah. What was it like the morning that you walk in, and now you're no longer dealing with just terrestrial radio, but now you're dealing with satellite radio? Is there any difference in your job description there, or does it just become a lot more work for you?
Yeah, I don't know if it changes the job description. I think it offered a new playing field. You know, radio, I won't say it's restrictive. I think, you know, when you're dealing with radio, you're dealing with a different beast. It is broadcasting. Mm-hmm. You know, we hit 2.5 million Canadians a week on CBC Music via terrestrial radio.
Oh, wow.
And you're hitting them whether they want to be hit or not. That's why it's funny. I always come out of things like CMW and the CCMAs with a kind of renewed sense of broadcasting. You know, we go coast to coast. Mm-hmm. The thing I loved about this, you know, the advent of satellites and digital service providers, was it meant that radio, which had a very narrow focus, suddenly satellite offered something a bit wider. Mm-hmm. You weren't getting the same three or four songs from a major artist. You'd get depth cuts. you know, maybe the hosts had a little more passion, things like that. Again, it was just a, it was a breath of fresh air compared to what radio had largely become, which was kind of static. You know, the, I mean, it was, you know, it's the evolving of sound and technology, I guess. And so what you end up with is, you know, it's a broader scope. It's just, it's a breath of fresh air in how things are done. Radio, you know, it always, it's always about audience. It's always about keeping that audience through the next commercial break. So it's really about 20 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
You know, we got to get them through that next quarter hour. I don't know that DSPs necessarily think any differently, but, you know, they're not as beholden to advertisers.
No, yeah.
It's subscription service, you know, and again, it's you know, it's a little stronger flavor than what you get on radio, I guess.
True that.
And there's an audience for it.
Yeah. Now, with obviously with technology advancing daily, the job of a programmer is no longer the way it used to be years ago, where DJs are scrambling to figure out what next track they're going to do during the commercial break. It's very much designed to run as a well-oiled machine, almost like a playlist. Can you break down in your experience how your career has transformed from the earlier years to today?
Boy, I mean, like everything else, it's changed dramatically. The first radio station I worked at was 1,000 watts daytime. It was an AM station, so it powered down at night.
Oh.
And at night we went to 250 watts, which meant that essentially you could not pick the station up in the station.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you'd power down, you'd walk out into the lobby, and the transistor radio on top of the filing cabinet
wasn't playing
somewhere. Well, it was playing something. There was a lot of static, and somewhere deep in the background was the Ann Murray song that you were actually playing.
Oh, wow. Why would a radio station power down like that at nighttime?
I can't remember. I mean, I'd be lying if I knew the reason. I don't know if they still do. I think they do. If you're ever listening to AM radio, occasionally you'll hear like a slight hiccup or something, and it sounds, and you will hear, you can tell that the power has dropped, your signal changes. AM radio suffers from what they call skip. So everybody powers down. You could pick up Edmonton AM radio in Vancouver.
Oh, wow.
I've listened to WABC out of New York between Toronto and Ottawa, clear as a bell at night. I don't know why they do it, but AM radio powered down at night. Maybe they don't anymore. I don't, you know.
That's interesting. Again,
that's a different area of the building than I'm in.
True that.
But, you know, now, I mean, you know, technology-wise now, voice tracking has changed everything. You know, automation has changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
You now have, you know, you, I mean, it's happening up here as well, but certainly in the U.S., you've had for a while now, you know, stations that have, you know, your announcer is in Florida, but he or she is heard in maybe 30 different states.
Oh,
they're the afternoon show for the whole hub. You know, that person you hear in Thunder Bay might be in Toronto, or they might be in Calgary.
We've actually, you know, I believe the one in Thunder Bay, actually, her name's Nashville Cat. So she comes straight out of Nashville and she's just broadcasted right onto our radio station.
Yeah, which is fine as long as you offer something local.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, that to me is an issue because somebody broadcasting out of Nashville doesn't care that it's minus 35 in Thunder Bay.
True that.
And again, to me, radio, it's always been, even though I work at a national outlet, it's always about local, or it should be, you know, unless you're talking a national countdown or something like that.
True that, which I do want to talk to you about some term of a countdown or a list here going on shortly. For artists that are beginning off and aren't sure, can we break down just how submissions come to you? Like, what about the MDS or Play MPE makes things extremely convenient for you?
Yeah, it makes it very convenient. I wouldn't weigh DMDS or Play MPE really any differently. They're kind of two sides of the same coin.
Okay.
They've probably doubled my emails because, you know, people tend to use both. Yeah, I mean, I get stuff from email. I get stuff sent to me directly from artists. Sirius sends over submissions if they get things.
Okay.
You know, I get stuff forwarded from the CBC Music Library. There's, I don't know, probably a dozen song players that I deal with. And then you've got reps for the major labels, indie reps for things like MDM Recordings, you know, and other sort of major indies, Open Road, things like that.
Yep.
So, I don't really care where it comes from. It really matters about how it sounds.
Perfect. I was just going to ask, what does hiring a radio tracker do for an independent artist? Does that help in terms of CBC? We won't talk about other programmers or anything, but in your turn, does it help that there's a radio tracker there available with that song, or would you rather have that connection with the independent artist right off the bat?
It's hard to deal directly with artists because they're really almost too close to the project.
True.
You know, or they can be.
Mm-hmm.
I think what a song plugger does is maybe it puts it on my radar a little quicker.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't mean it's an instant ad. It maybe gives it a little more weight in the triage that I have to do to kind of separate things out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to the song. And I don't care if it comes from a plugger or not, but a plugger, you know, a good plugger understands your format, understands kind of what you're looking for,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully understands the artist that they're pitching to, you know. I think if you're just starting out, you can do a lot of it on your own. I think it's a good learning process.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, learning the business is never a bad thing. You know, you kind of need to know what a manager does and when you need one. When you're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same with song pluggers. People can, you know, there's always someone out there waiting to take your money.
Ain't that the truth?
You know, and that's the reality of any business.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were talking before we started this, the whole idea that, there's so many wrinkles to this industry, and when you're starting out, you kind of got to know all of them, and it's impossible to.
Yeah,
because you've never done it before. So again, learning process is good, and even if you do immediately hire a record plugger, I think learning before you do all that and doing some homework, you know, there's no point in hiring a plugger if all they plug is heavy metal.
Yeah.
You got to see what their track record was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I it's like anything else. I don't think there's anything wrong with reaching out to an artist and saying, hey, you use this person or this company.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
I do it daily.
Yeah. There's a whole network of people who you can tap into.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the day, you got to write a good song.
It all comes down to that one song. If you don't have the music, you can't do anything else with it.
Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. it's like anything else. Like, you know, a well-produced bad song is still a bad song, even if the production's great.
Yeah, unless for some strange reason it became like really big on American Idol.
Yeah.
Oh man. So I'm really curious, what a week in the life of your team is. Now I know it's not just you. You do have a full team behind you that helps you out with this stuff. Thank goodness, because I couldn't even imagine. What's it like Monday to Friday at the office for you?
What's an office?
Well, your home,
it's been, what, 21 months now? 20 months? I don't know. Again, I juggle so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the only thing I program for Sirius is CBC Country.
Yeah.
Everything else I do is CBC. So I'm involved in the daytime programming of the morning and afternoon show. I program the overnight show. I provide Radio One, all the like regional and local shows from coast to coast. I provide 15 songs a week to them. Seven CBC digital music channels. 700 emails a week from labels, promo people, song pluggers, artists, etc. So a week is busy.
I was going to say, what time do you get to sleep?
Early, because I wake up way, way, way too early.
Fair enough. 9 a.m. for me was early this morning. I'm assuming you were up like 6. Oh, boy.
Earlier.
Oh, boy.
I've been awake since about 3:15, actually.
My goodness.
Yeah. But, you know, that's just the time I wake up.
Touché.
But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I program 210 hours of live radio every week, which sounds like a lot, and it is, but, it, you know, a lot of that is basically a push of a button and then organizing. But, you know, the bulk of my time is spent listening to music. I'm forever, you know, I'm in the new content business.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always looking for new content.
Out of curiosity, how much percentage would you say that you could actually get through and listen out of all of those emails?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. Because again, a lot of those emails are just notifying you of things on DMDS.
True that, yeah.
And I'm already on, you know, I'm already there looking at what's coming or play MPE or whatever. Again, that's where the triage comes in. You know, you've only got so much time. So there, you know, if a key song plugger drops me a note and says, you know, here's four songs, then those are going into some kind of list that I, you know, I try and listen to as much as I can. You know, priority being given to things that I'm almost certain I can program. It's the stuff that you got to dig a little deeper that takes the time.
Fair enough. Is there certain ones where you're almost like an automatic click for a yes button or?
You know, I mean, at the end of the day, if you're talking about a bigger act, like we're not talking, you know, an indie emerging artist. I mean, if Brett Kissel puts something out, I don't have to think too much about it. It's just going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's a no brainer. I always say the hardest records for me are the ones that are this close because they're well constructed. They're just missing an intangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that those are the hard ones, the ones where it's finished and you go, well, I like it, but is it good enough?
Yeah.
And so you listen again and again and again and again. You know, there's no rhyme or reason. So the team, Sarah Burke over at XM kind of oversees everything that I do. From day one of this thing, I think I picked every song that's gone on the air. I am the team, largely.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is we don't really have a lot of... I mean, there's a team that I work with, but when it comes down to, like, the individual programming elements, you're kind of on your own.
Yep.
You're looking at charts, you're, you know... You're looking for influencers, but at the end of the day, you got to listen to everyone.
Yeah. What captures your attention first? Is it the story that you get with the song? Is it the stats? Is it the sender?
At the end of it's the song.
Yeah.
It has to be the song. You know, and then it comes down to, you know, there's a variety of things. Energy, vocal performance is big. And just something. It's got to have what I call momentum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've learned, I don't write songs. I don't play an instrument. But I've learned over the years, as I've become this critiquer of new music, you know, there's a lot of elements. I always think in songwriting that it's kind of like building a house. As long as it's got a good foundation, you can put anything on top of it.
True that.
And sometimes what I end up with is a song where I think the foundation's okay, but the stairs are crooked or the second floor's not level. There's something that just makes you go, it's not there.
True that.
And then you get something where it's a great foundation. And honestly, you can put anything on top of that. As long as it's got, you know, momentum and it's decent, it's got a hook and it's built well, it's probably going to last. And I also try not to overthink things at the end of the day.
That's a great idea. Some of us artists should probably catch on to that.
Yeah, well, again, you know, that's an issue is, you know, with artists, you got to know when to walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now, hard.
True. Now, say my single gets on there. What's the next step for it? Does each song get the same opportunity of spins?
Pretty much. All the emerging acts get anywhere from about 11 to maybe 14 spins a week.
Okay.
I have a 6-month window from the date of release for acts to be considered emerging and new. You know, at the start of this thing 6 years ago when we started CBC Country, pretty much everything stayed for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
As the quality and quantity has gone up,
yeah,
I'm able to rotate those things in and out quicker, which I think ultimately is better for the artist too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it means I get to more independent emerging acts and you're getting a more realistic kind of sense of rotation and things like that.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you're aware, there's a company out there called ShineX now. And ShineX basically takes all the SRDSs and they'll set them up in a type of a chart for you to kind of understand where your royalties are on satellite radio. But now they also have this thing called a chart. So now they tell you who's getting played the most. So I'm always curious about that. Like, I guess the way that it looks like is almost like it runs an algorithm. So I guess right off the bat, does CBC run an algorithm for their playlists? And can you elaborate on what an algorithm is?
I don't know. I don't know what you just said.
Perfect.
What's an SDS?
SRDS. So I guess it's like the satellite tracking system. Okay. Yeah. So
honestly, I know nothing about any of that back end stuff. Like I know, I think it's Sound Exchange. Is that where?
Yeah.
That's where the checks are generated. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how much people get, like, I don't care at the end of the day.
Fair enough.
That's on, you know, the artist's part.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly makes me very popular.
Extremely.
but yeah, I don't know a lot about that stuff.
Okay. Is there like a major rotation for, say, a signed artist as opposed to an independent artist? Like, would Brett Kissel would get more plays than Aaron Allen would, or something like that?
Well, at the end of the day, it's primary and secondary.
Okay.
Like, you know, like any radio station, any satellite station, they're, you know, they have their key top 40 or 50 tracks. Then their secondaries, the up and comers and the ones that are maybe tumbling down the chart. In some cases, they have a recurrent category and then various categories of gold.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, the whole thing with CBC Country was really about just making sure that I tracked the emerging artists properly. And I want to try and get to as many as I can. I mean, at any given time, I'm playing 110 indie acts.
Mm-hmm.
120 might be too many. It might thin it out a little. You know, if you go less, then I think people are probably getting too many spins. Yep. And it eliminates more people. I've always been a more people in the pool thing. I'm just here to facilitate it. To me, the audience decides.
One of the major reasons why I switched from our local country station to more of the satellite country was because of the oversaturation of the same 30 songs all the time.
Yep.
Yeah. So I applaud you for that, because other than you might hear the same song come on maybe every like 6 hours on CBC, but that's about it. You won't hear that song come on again for quite a bit.
Unless there's a problem with our programming, which happens occasionally.
Oh, you know, like you're only as good as technology. Haywire. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What other programs does CBC provide? I've been hearing on the radio about the video interviews that you guys are doing through the app as well.
Talking CBC Country?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, fair enough.
All I do is program music.
Fair enough.
You know, most of everything else is handled by Sarah at XM. You know, we're doing a live thing from the CCMAs this Friday.
Perfect. I'll be listening.
With their top of the country thing with the Reclaws performing.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a year-end countdown, which I'm working on today. That'll run through December. So that's kind of where, you know, that's my involvement. You know, Sarah, I mean, back when we used to have festivals, Sarah would do reports from festivals all summer long. So we do special, you know, special programming like that. Most of that is done by them.
Perfect.
Well, on a, initiated by them.
On a completely off topic, did you hear the Boots at Hearts announce their lineup for next year?
No.
They have Shania Twain. They have Florida Georgia Line. And who is the last guy on the show? Those are just the headliners. I can't remember. I think Chase Rice or something like that. But they just announced this morning. So,
wow. So yeah. you're starting to see stuff roll out.
Mm-hmm. We also, Country on the Bay, it's Dauphin, Manitoba's sister station or sister festival. And we are announcing for July of next year. Toby Keith's going to be the headliner on that one. So
that's also, that's good to see. I like that. I like that mm-hmm. Dauphin and T-Bay have teamed up. I think that's important.
It
on
is.
On a touring level, you know, mm-hmm. there's some clout. If you're going to get those people up here playing, give them more than one date.
Exactly.
And they'll stay up here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's the same with the folk circuit, right? If you can go and play Canmore and then come back and play Edmonton or the Winnipeg Folk Festival, you know, the summer months are about touring and festivals.
Exactly. Yep. 100%. Now, yeah. When it comes to gender, there is no secret that there has been talks about female country artists and male country artists not getting the same airplay rotation. To be 100% honest, I personally feel that there is a huge amount of female talent out there. And I personally believe the CBC runs very well in terms of male to female plays. I feel as though I hear just as many females as I do males. So in your opinion, do you even have an opinion on this issue? And has it being sort of brought to light changed your way the team does programming, or has it always been the exact same way for you?
I'd say it's always been the exact same way for me. Radio is full of these little rules that they love to come up with. You know, people only listen for so many minutes, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was always this idea. I can remember I've actually worked with the guy who floated this idea first about, you know, the idea that you shouldn't have two females back to back. That was like an unwritten rule for a while. I've never understood it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like anything. Nobody turns the radio on to hear females or males. Nobody turns the radio on, you know, to hear, dare I say it, Canadian music. You know what I mean? People tune in for music.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really care where it's from. They like it if it, I think that, you know, I think shows like Idol have proven that people want to support their neighbors.
Yeah.
You got talent down the street, you want to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the whole female thing, I mean, I try not to think about it. With that said, you know, I provide 15 songs a week across the country. I do look and see how many females are in that 15. But I'm also looking at, is there something from the Maritimes? Do I have, you know, is everybody from Toronto?
Yeah.
There's that. But again, they're kind of on the periphery. You know, it all works out in the end. I've never had an issue or, you know, felt a need to kind of count how many males or females I've got. I think it balances out itself. And if there's more talented females, then you're going to hear more females.
Yeah. The amount of female talent that is out there is astronomical.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just on country. I mean, you're seeing, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like the indie rock world.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's just this wave of, you know, women with guitars who appear to have been influenced by acts like Nirvana.
Yeah.
You know, they've been working in home DIY kind of recordings, and you're getting this wave of really interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think COVID and having people being able to sit behind their own computers for a while has really kind of like influenced people on how they're doing their next steps.
Well, and you're getting, you know, again, things like Zoom, you're getting mm-hmm. more collaborative things. People don't have to fly somewhere. They don't, you know, you can do this over the phone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So where do you see the future of Canadian country music? Do you still see a US and a Canada market? Have we narrowed the gap? Is the gap even still there?
I mean, I think Australia is a really interesting market these days. I think that's kind of an alternative to the US, or, you know, not even an alternative, just another option.
Yeah.
You know, I think, again, you got to look at the whole world. If you can, you know, figure out a way to get into the UK and deal with country music there, it doesn't hurt. I mean, everybody moves to Nashville, but you're starting to see, you know, indie. I don't know if it's, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if there's been some initiative with Australia. You're just, I'm starting to see indie acts here getting Australian airplay. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, the thing with Australia is it's a very similar market to Canada. It's about the same size.
Yeah.
You know, geographically, population wise. And there's a huge country market. Yeah, I don't know where the future goes. I just think, you know, there's territories that can be explored.
Fair enough.
And ultimately, as, you know, we come out of this pandemic, it's about how do you, you know, as your audience builds, you got to keep looking for more audience. And at some point, if that means going and playing in the US for 5 or 6 months, you got to do it.
Yep. Go where it goes.
Yeah. You know, again, if your game is to be a success in country music, you've got to be able to take it everywhere. You know, you can only tour Canada so many times.
True.
And it just opens up the marketplace. But I think there's also a sacrifice to do that. You know, you got to be willing to go away from home for 6 months. Exactly. You got to be willing to go and open for someone. You know, I think for a Canadian act looking at the US, you're almost expected to take a step back because, again, you're coming in as the new guy.
Yeah.
No matter what you've done here.
Yeah.
You're still going to be the new guy opening for Kenny Chesney or whoever it might be, but you're getting that audience.
Exactly. I'm thinking right now, like James Barker Band just got signed down there and Aaron Goodwin just got his song Lonely Drum down there. And I was actually talking with Aaron and I'm like, why did you put Lonely Drum as your American hit? And he's like, that's my single. And I'm like, that song is like six singles behind Canada. He's like, that's how far behind I am there.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I that didn't even click into my head that that's just how much of a leap back you have to go back almost.
Yeah. 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 You, I mean, you're restarting your career.
Yeah.
You know, to me, there's, you know, there's people in Nashville, they don't care what you did in Red Deer.
No.
You know, it's, they got a stack of new acts and the best acts are the ones at the top.
Yeah, if you got to compete with this one. If not, then you're down here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, there's the whole A&R thing. If your A&R guy isn't, if you don't have an A&R guy in your corner, you've probably got nobody fighting for you, you know, on your project.
True that.
You know, over the years, you always hear, you know, there's always an American adage of, well, whatever airplay you get in Canada, the government has forced that. Because of CanCon rules.
Yeah.
So they don't, you know, they can whitewash your success.
Does the CanCon rule affect you as well?
In what way?
In terms of like the Canadian content, well, I guess like CBC would only be Canadian country music anyways, but do you have any other radio stations where that actually affects your day-to-day routine?
I suppose it always affects the day-to-day routine. I'm a huge fan of CanCon. I think it trickles down so far. You know, we live next to this giant thing called the United States that has a massive influence. And what the CanCon rules do is they obviously help artists. They help songwriters. They help recording studios, producers. They help graphic artists. They help promoters. They help agents, managers. They help club bookers, festival organizers. You know, everything, you know, anything that Canadian artists touch is involved in CanCon. The money trickles down. You know, I'm a big fan. What I would love to see, and I've talked about this for a while now, I'd love to see them try and change the rules so that they're weighted toward new music. I'd like to see like a 5-year kind of sliding scale.
Oh, okay.
So if you release something on November 23rd, 2021, it gets full CanCon status until, you know, November 23rd, 2026.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then it drops. You know, you have to think about stations that play gold, right? You don't necessarily want to force a radio station to change their format, but I don't think you should get the same weight for playing something brand new as you get for playing Trooper.
True.
Or the Guess Who. You know, but I think ultimately CanCon is a boon to this industry.
True that.
And all right. At the end of the day, our artists go around the world.
Yeah. You are very correct in that.
You know.
Oh, man. This interview has been just like, I'm going to have to sit here and listen time and time again with the amount of information that comes out of your mind, sir. But we're down to the final question. So, having given all the information that you have, Julian, and we have songs on satellite radio and we are all over the world, what would be the biggest piece of advice to give up and coming independent country artists like myself?
Oh, there's a bunch of things.
I got my pen and paper ready.
I mean, it really depends on where you're at, you know, in the evolving of your career. I think if you're just starting out, learn to take criticism. You know, as long as it's constructive. You know, I'm not saying you suck, I'm saying this song could be better. You know, I mean, again, it's not so much advice. What I hear a lot of times with young indie acts is a lack of confidence. And I don't know how you get that. I mean, the reality is when you walk into a recording studio, it's like stepping into a spaceship.
Yep.
And if you're brand new, it's an overwhelming world. You don't really know what you're doing. You hope the people on the other side of the glass do. And so I'll often hear new music and think that the vocalist is very conscious of both the pressure of this being a take.
Yeah.
But also hearing your voice in your headphones, you're in a completely different world. And, you know, I get submissions where I honestly can't believe someone got on the talkback and said, come on in. I think we nailed it.
Yeah. True that.
You need to be able to realistically look and go, no, that can be better.
I think there's times where like a recording studio doesn't know necessarily that they're also the producer of the song.
Yeah.
So they'll sit there and they'll be like, did you like it? And somebody will be like, yeah, I like that take. They're like, okay. But even in their heads, they're like, sure, I'll take the paycheck for this.
They're happy.
Yeah.
The guy writing the check's happy. So exactly. Why do I care?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But now I notice that a lot more producers out there are actually the ones in the recording studios as well. So that's been a nice little field to actually have that person that knows kind of where it should go. Because as an independent, I'm one of those ones where I walk into the studio and I'm like, all right, today's the day. Let's do this. And I'll put down my vocals and I'll think it's okay. But he'll be like, did you hear this part? And I'll be like, no. And he'll be like, let me turn it up a little bit for you. So you listen to it in the headphones and all of a sudden you're like, oh, why? Where did that note come from? And they're like, yeah, we got to take that out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like anything else. You have to be self-critical. And then the other point I was thinking that I jotted down was about songwriting. You know, you look at, and you hate to compare up-and-comers or someone starting out to seasoned songwriters, but seasoned songwriters do it right.
Yeah.
They are in service to the song. I hear a lot of young songwriters who are in service to the story they're trying to tell. And as soon as you start to write a song, you're in service to the song, not the story.
Yeah.
The story will come out in how you tell it. But you got to, the point is the song. You go back when Tom Petty died.
Yeah.
And you went through that catalog and you just realized that every single song, hits and non-hits, all had that element. He was in service to whatever that song was. And the words are perfect.
Yeah.
Right? He hasn't, I often hear, you'll hear someone sing a line and it just doesn't sound right. And they forced it in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, no, you haven't finished writing the song.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't get through it normally and you got to twist it around, you've got the wrong word and you're not done yet.
No, yeah, you're just filling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so I see that a lot. I'm also, luckily, after 6 years of this, seeing a lot of acts who, you know, maybe sent me something 3 or 4 years ago who are coming back with better stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, they've gone to they've stepped up with a producer. They've maybe bought a song.
Yeah.
You know, that's what a lot of the money does that trickles through CBC Country and back out into the artistic field is it allows people to, you know, use a better studio, get a producer, maybe hire a better band.
Exactly.
And just, you know, take a little more time. And there's, you know, the thing I hear a lot from acts that I have played is just the confidence of hearing yourself in the mix with acts. You know, because it's like, oh, you know what? I do fit. I can sit next to this.
Yeah, it is an extremely humbling feeling when you have Brett Kissel play and then your song comes on and then Gord Bamford plays right after it. And you're just like, wow, as if I was just in that mix and the quality of everything just sounded the exact same.
Yeah. Yeah. There isn't a lot of difference. Again, that comes down to, you know, sonically you'll get a song and you just think this just isn't ready. It just doesn't sound right. The big thing with this job for me has been figuring out how to say no to people. Because it's hard. Nobody wants to hear it, you know?
Nope.
As I'm fond of saying at conferences, sometimes my job is to explain to you that you have an ugly baby.
True that.
Right?
True that. And nobody wants to hear that they have an ugly baby.
Nobody wants to hear that. And again, that's where, you know, dealing directly with artists can be tough. Because I am. I'm telling you your baby's ugly.
Yeah.
And at least if I tell your manager that your baby's ugly, it's your manager's problem to explain that to
you. Yeah. And he'll try and tell you that there's a blemish on the baby's face a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, that's like I say, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to jump into the pool, you got to be ready to hear.
You got to know how to swim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're expecting rainbows and unicorns, you're going to be disappointed pretty quick,
very quickly,
you know,
unless by all means, unless somehow you manage to be this talented person that came out of nowhere, which congratulations, Luke Combs.
Hey, you know, if songs run down your arm and out onto the page, good for you.
Yeah, true that.
But you know, I know really good songwriters who tell me that in a good year they might write 10. Maybe
10 good ones. They've written thousands of songs.
There's 100 in the drawer that aren't finished.
Yeah.
But 10 where it's kind of like that one's done.
Yeah. I'm also in that feeling.
Yeah. And that's normal, right? Like songwriters do that. There was a great Guy Clark documentary that I saw a couple of years ago. And he talked about a song that he and his wife had been trying to write for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
There was 30 years.
There's and another country out song that was like that too.
You know, they'd bring it out every once in a while and be like, you know, what's missing? And they could never quite get it.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was one of Zac Brown Band songs. I remember them telling a similar story where they had that song sitting for like 15 years and it was the bridge that they couldn't figure out.
Yeah.
And then finally one day the bridge came to them and they're like, finally, now we've got it. And they released it and it went number one. I can't remember what it was. Though. It wasn't Chicken Fried, but.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's that Beatles documentary that's coming this month.
Mm-hmm.
People ought to watch that.
I think it's going to be good. And I like that it's the actual Beatles and it's not like an actor or anything. Like,
Well, just the idea that, you know, we haven't seen this footage.
No.
You know, and, you know, let's face it, they were in a unique situation. Mm-hmm. They got to use Abbey Road recording studios at will.
Right.
Right. Like nobody else got that room. It was theirs. So yeah. They got to play around. Money was no object. But it's amazing. You know, there was a McCartney interview recently. And you just get the sense that these guys would, you know, it was very workmanlike. They'd show up at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
They'd work till 5. They'd break for lunch. But they might also knock off 2 songs in the morning and another one in the afternoon. And those songs would be like Something.
Yeah.
Or Get Back or some huge Beatles song.
Yeah.
That, and it's just, you know, they allowed the ideas to flow and never said no. Mm-hmm. And you had George Martin, who was the greatest producer ever.
Touché.
The Beatles, you know, the Beatles are Herman's Hermits.
Mm-hmm.
Without George Martin, he was exactly. The studio genius. He was the guy who said, this needs a French horn.
Mm-hmm.
This needs a string quartet. And he played on so much.
Yeah.
All the early Beatles tunes, the rock and roll stuff with all that boogie woogie piano.
Yeah.
That's all George Martin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Jeepers.
But just the creative process and the idea that, you know, there's a clip from this Beatles doc where you see, I think it's George Harrison working on Something and he hasn't got the words right. And John just says, well, sing whatever until you find the right word. But they had that option.
True.
And you're writing a song with, you know, Lennon and McCartney in the room with you.
Mm-hmm.
I could write a great song if Bob Dylan was sitting on the couch right now.
I'm pretty certain I'd be able to, too.
You know,
Bob's heck, I might even be able to make a good song with Yoko Ono at this point.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, Julian, it has truly been an honor to have you on this podcast. When I first started, I had this vision of being able to talk to industry members and kind of be able to ask the questions that I'm sure all artists have that some of us don't get the opportunity to. I know I am not alone when I say thank you so much. It is truly a career-changing moment as an artist to be added to CBC. To the fans that are listening in today, when a bar like this was added, I was in my hometown, which listeners know I moved from 14 years ago. I was outside the store and it came on the truck, and the missus, being the number one fan that she is, she blasted it through the windows, and it was truly a surreal moment for me to have about 20 to 30 of the people that I grew up with that have seen me as the 4-year-old child now have this song on the radio. So from that, it's honestly an incredible experience. And from a business standpoint, having a song land on SiriusXM can basically finance your next song. So in every aspect, it's truly life-changing. So honestly, Julian, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for not just changing my life and career, but for each and every single artist who lives with these changes daily. So again, thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, you're most welcome. And thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I cannot wait to listen to this again and again and again. Well, there you have it, everyone. My amazing interview with Mr. Julian Tuck. I hope you all gained as much knowledge about this programming aspect as I did. I did forget 2 questions for Julian during the interview, which I emailed and asked him. The first one was, what's the strangest submission someone's ever given him? He said, and I quote, I have a desk drawer where I keep some of the doozies. I once got a submission from a record label in Montreal. It came in an envelope with Alberta Medical Association scratched out on the front, sealed with Home Depot tape. I've received burned discs with a handwritten note ripped off a notebook. If they aren't going to take their career seriously, why should I? I got one with extra copies to pass on to Q, where the first song was called Lay a Whammy on O'Sammy. I threw that one in the garbage, but a coworker convinced me to keep it with a quote, it'll be evidence for when this guy kills you with a crossbow for not passing it on to Q. It's really amazing how some people choose to present their art for airplay. The last question I asked was, in all the years that he's worked in radio and label, does Julian Tuck still get starstruck? And his response was, it's always weird meeting the big ones. Looking at Island Records, I got to work a couple of U2 shows over the years. I spent Labor Day weekend in the 90s hanging out at Exhibition Stadium as a local working rep. Sat in the empty stadium watching soundcheck where I waited for my tickets and passes. I sat in 9th row for the first night, which was really too close for that production. And at the soundboard on the second night, the privileges of having pass access. did a meet and greet with Edge and Adam where they met the label execs and then killed time waiting for traffic to die down at the after show, where I found myself in a circle with a few Blue Jay players and Bono. The weird thing with the superstars is that you have a sort of out-of-body experience where you just are chit-chatting with Bono, but you're also wrestling in your head the fact that you are chatting with Bono. Also worth noting that the Jays, who were playing out of the Sky Dome back then, to a man, could not tell me the score of their game that afternoon. They knew they won, but that was all that they retained. Most of my fond memories of artist interactions, especially in my label years, were just kind of neat situations. Niles Fulgren from Springsteen's band came into London, Ontario in the early 90s for a show with his band, and I spent the day taking to him to a couple of interviews. He borrowed my cell phone. Not very many people had cell phones back in 1990 and 91. And he called Kevin McHale of the Boston Celtics on my phone because he was going to be in Boston later on that week and wanted tickets. When Art Neville of the Neville Brothers Band died a few years back, I was reminded of working with him one Sunday when they were in Toronto to play Ontario Place. Sunday shopping wasn't a thing back then, so I spent about an hour driving Art Neville around Toronto looking for a drugstore. Art needed, and I kid you not, and this is what I remember when I hear about the man's passing. Art needed a box of extra large condoms and a 12-inch ruler. Extreme pretty much broke up in the back of Julian's Acura, true story. And I got to play a round of golf with Alice Cooper, where a very drunk Meatloaf showed up mid-round because he heard that Alice was out on the course and wanted to say hello. Sitting in a golf cart, looking past Alice Cooper, chatting with Meatloaf. It sure did beat a real job. Next week on the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, we have an incredible female singer to end off the end of our first season. Hayley Verall, you've probably heard her a million and a half times with her song Dance Around It, and she has a brand new one out that we're going to chat with again. My name is Tim Albertson. You can check out my music at www.timalbertsonmusic.ca. Also, make sure to follow us on Facebook by searching the Canadian Country Music Podcast, or follow and subscribe to our YouTube page where you can check out the video of the interview as well as YouTube exclusive questions not found on the audio edition of this podcast. Also, watch the premiere of our videos because we also bring the artists into the live chat rooms for you, so you can actually chat with the artists while you're watching the video. Just search the Canadian Country Music Podcast on YouTube, hit that subscribe button, and follow us up. If you're an artist and you have any insight you want to share about your experiences in this crazy music industry, please, please email us at theccmcast@gmail.com. Until next week, everyone, remember that love is always free, and I will see you all next time on the Canadian Country Music Podcast.